Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with interesting stories from around the world, and we tell them to you in a way that helps you learn and improve your American English. We begin today with a visit to the American West, where an event called a rodeo brings a lot of people together with many different types of animals. Then we will have an animal story of a different kind. This one deals with the recent deaths of whales in Alaskan waters. So let's get started and head out west with Jill Robbins.
Rodeos are hugely popular sport events in the western states of America, where horseback riding, livestock animals, and fancy rope skills are featured. Thousands of cowboys and cowgirls compete to see who has the best rodeo skills. They celebrate the cowboy traditions and culture that is rooted in the West. Rodeos are also big business for those states. Many of the participants are from families who have been in the industry for several generations. The competitions bring in about $250 million of revenue each year. VOA Learning English recently attended a rodeo in Oklahoma. The Elk City Rodeo of Champions began entertaining crowds 77 years ago. The three-day event is the third largest rodeo in the state. About 14,000 people attend each September. About 300 people compete in the events. All the action at the Elk City Rodeo took place outside. It began with a daring skydiver who floated into the middle of the arena with a huge U.S. flag. Then the crowd stood for an a cappella version of the national anthem. The competition kicked off with bareback bronc riding. A bronc is a horse that bucks or jumps and kicks high to throw off its rider. A bareback bronc rider has to stay on top of the bucking horse for 8 seconds to qualify for judging. Cowboy Will Lowe of Texas was among the competitors. We asked him about the horses he rides. A bronc, he said.
It's just a wild horse, you know, one that's never been broke, just getting to play and do what it really wants to do.
And that play is bucking. Without it, the competition could not happen.
Yeah, you really want them to jump real high in the front end, and you want them to extend their back feet all the way. You want them to try to buck you off.
We asked Lowe how and why he got into this dangerous line of work.
Well, it started when I was real little, you know. I wanted to ride bulls when I was little, and my parents wouldn't let me ride bulls, so we had bucking horses, and so I got to ride bucking horses, and it just stuck.
Will Lowe has had great success. He has won the world championship 3 times. He hopes to compete for his 4th world championship in December. Bareback bronc riding is among what is called rough stock competition. Saddle bronc and bull riding are also in that category. Rodeos also have timed events, such as calf roping and barrel racing. Rodeo cowboys are not the only performers that face danger in the arena. Rodeo clowns, called bullfighters, have a very risky job. as well. The clowns are trained to distract the bull when a rider falls off. This helps keep the rider from being trampled on. Bullfighter Justin Rumford calls it playing with the bulls. Rumford has been a rodeo clown for 6 years, and he receives more than just laughs. Rodeo's governing group, the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, has named him Clown of the Year 3 times. However, the clown has also taken some hard hits as a bullfighter. He said he had broken many bones, injured internal organs, and spent time in the hospital. But he still loves what he does, he said. A main feature of the event is livestock. The Butler & Son Rodeo Company is the stock contractor for the Elk City Rodeo and many others. The family business is based in Elk City. Rhett Butler is a leader of the company. The Butler brothers have been in the rodeo business
since 1929, and I'm the fourth generation. My son's the fifth generation, and this is our hometown show here at Elk City, and we just bring all the bucking horses, the bulls, the calves, the steers, everything involved with the rodeo. We bring it all to town and try to put on a good show for everybody.
The audience on Friday night cheered for their favorite riders and ropers, laughed at the clowns, and rocked to country music at the Elk City Rodeo of Champions, Under the Stars. I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. American scientists have reported a sharp increase in the number of dead whales found in the Gulf of Alaska. From May through August, 30 whales washed up along the coast. Scientists say there may be a connection between the animals' deaths and warming waters. Bob Doty reports.
Deborah Fauquier is a marine mammal scientist at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She wants to learn why so many whales have died this year.
And the average for the whole year generally is 8. So it's definitely significantly elevated, and for us that was a reason for concern.
She says scientists have formed some ideas about what caused the deaths.
We might be able to, you know, figure out, is it a virus? Is it a ship strike? Is it a harmful algal bloom?
Algae are simply plants or plant-like organisms. Most algae are safe, but scientists say the less common toxic alga can cause brain damage or even death. In June, the largest alga bloom in more than 10 years was seen along the Pacific coast, from California to Alaska. Scientists say it grew big because of warm water and sunny, calm weather. The alga bloom forced officials to close fishing areas in several states. Deborah Fauquier says scientists will look for evidence of the harmful alga in the whales.
So some of the whales actually filter the phytoplankton and the zooplankton, which are the little insects that eat the grass in the sea, basically. So they get the toxin directly from that method. The other one is they eat the fish that eat those. So it just depends where on the food web they eat. And as you go higher up the food web, more toxin gets concentrated.
The waters around Alaska began warming in 2014. The water temperature continues rising. It is now 3 degrees Celsius warmer than normal. Scientists blame the weather event known as El Niño and wind patterns for the warming. The scientists say the warming is not linked to climate change, but industrial gas emissions are warming the planet. They are causing the Arctic to warm faster than anywhere else. At the beginning of the melt season, Arctic sea ice was at its lowest level ever recorded. Mrs. Fauquier says that is a problem for marine mammals. Polar bears and walruses, for example, live and breed on the ice and use it as a place from which to hunt.
for Arctic species, species that normally like cold water, it's going to change the phytoplankton, so it's going to change that the base of the food web. It's going to change the fish. They may go farther north because they don't like warm water. And so then the predators that are mobile are going to have to either follow those fish, or if they can't follow them, then they can starve.
Mrs. Fauquier says NOAA hopes to learn why so many whales died. She said knowing the cause is the first step to understanding how to solve the problem. I'm Bob Doty.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. China is Vietnam's biggest trading partner. However, the two countries are competitors in international trade. Now, Vietnam is taking steps to deal with China's surprise decision to devalue its currency. Vietnam is also making an effort to increase its exports in a very competitive part of the world. In August, the value of China's money fell by 3.5% against other currencies in foreign exchange markets. In recent months, the value of the Japanese yen, the Korean won, and other Asian currencies also fell. That made exports from those countries less costly. Vietnam let the value of its currency, the dong, go down 2 times earlier this year. The idea was to gain more foreign investment in the country. Manufacturing is an important part of Vietnam's economy. In fact, the manufacturing sector grew by nearly 9% last year. However, Vietnam faces strong competition from its trading partners. Vietnam also could face a flood of Chinese imports as China seeks new markets for its goods. The reason for those imports? Slowing demand for goods in China. Pham Lu Hong is with SSI Research in Hanoi. He says low taxes and problems in China are resulting in more shipments of Chinese trucks and steel to Vietnam. Some Asian countries are improving roads, air, and seaports, and other infrastructure in an effort to increase trade. Like many Southeast Asian nations, Vietnam is seeking money for infrastructure projects. The planned improvements are to meet the demands of international cargo shippers. Vietnam has accepted development aid from Japan to build a new airport terminal in Hanoi. The building is expected to open this year. More aid has gone to help build Ho Chi Minh City's public transportation system, which has yet to open. With better infrastructure and low-cost labor, Vietnam hopes to develop high-value manufacturing industries to replace the clothing industry. Major technology companies such as Intel in the U.S. and Samsung in South Korea have invested billions of dollars in Vietnam since 2010. Sandeep Mahajan is an economist with the World Bank. He says Vietnam needs to do more to make land and financing available to private business. That way, he says, local companies can join the factory supply chain. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. James Madison of Virginia was elected President of the United States in 1808. He was inaugurated in Washington on March 4, 1809. The people of the city were happy with the new president, but the nation was not yet sure what kind of leader he would be. Madison's first 4 years were not easy. He had to deal with a foreign policy problem that the former president, Thomas Jefferson, was not able to solve: increasingly tense relations with Britain. Historian Alan Taylor has written several books on early American history and has won a Pulitzer Prize for his writing. He says Madison took office under difficult circumstances.
Jefferson, in many ways, was a tough act to follow because he'd been extraordinarily popular. But he had made one great policy mistake with Madison's support. Madison had been his Secretary of State. And that mistake was something known as the embargo.
The embargo had arisen from a war between Britain and France. The two nations refused to honor America's neutrality. Each tried to prevent the United States from trading with the other. Both interfered with American shipping, and the British Navy sometimes seized American sailors. President Jefferson ordered a ban on trade with Europe, but the embargo failed to end the hostile acts against the United States. A month after Madison took office, the British minister in Washington, David Erskine, said Britain would stop seizing American ships if the United States would trade again with Britain. But Erskine did not make clear that the British government demanded several conditions. One condition was that the United States continue the ban against trade with France. Another was that Britain be permitted to capture American ships that violated the law. President Madison did not accept these conditions, but he still believed he had reached an agreement with the British minister. He announced that the United States would reopen trade with Britain. Hundreds of ships left American ports. But a few weeks later, Madison received surprising news. The British government had rejected the agreement he reached with Erskine. Letters were exchanged, but Madison could not get a good explanation for what had happened. He finally broke off all communications, and Erskine and his replacement left Washington. America's policy of trade with Britain and France continued to be a serious issue. President Madison approved trade with all countries in 1810. But when relations with Britain did not improve, he stopped trade with the country again in the spring of 1811. Trade was not the only problem, however. A growing number of Americans believed that the British were helping some Native Americans to fight the United States. As the people of the United States began to move to the northern and western territories, the government made treaties with the different Indian tribes. The treaties explained which land belonged to the Indians and which land could be settled by white people. The settlers did not always honor the treaties. Historian Alan Taylor explains that Indian tribes were trying to defend their homelands. He says they asked the British to provide them with guns and ammunition to fight against the American settlements.
And the British were playing a very ambivalent game. In other words, they wanted to keep the Indians on a kind of retainer. In the eventuality that war did happen, they would want to mobilize those Indians. So they did provide them with guns and ammunition, but they hoped that the native peoples would just use them on the defensive.
A leader of the Shawnee Indian tribe, Tecumseh, decided to unite all Indians and help them defend against the settlers. Throughout the West, many Americans believed that the British in Canada were responsible for Tecumseh's efforts. They demanded war with Britain to destroy the power of the tribes. In Washington, a new Congress was meeting. Some of the new members were very different from the men who had controlled Congress before. They were less willing to compromise and more willing to defend America's interests. They soon got the name War Hawks. At the same time, America had a new Secretary of State. Madison chose his close friend, James Monroe. What the United States did not have at that troubled time was a representative in Britain. The British minister in Washington, Francis James Jackson, returned to London when Madison broke off communications. The American minister in London, William Pinckney, sailed home as well. There was no official in either capital to report what was happening. And in the spring of 1812, the United States and Britain were moving closer to war. President Madison had hoped for some sign of compromise, but he was sure there would be war. He had seen the instructions from London to Britain's new minister in Washington, Augustus Foster. The foreign minister warned Foster to say nothing about any compromise. He wanted the United States to see how firmly Britain would stand against neutral trade with its enemies. Also, historian Alan Taylor says, the United States did not believe Britain would stop inspecting American ships and taking away any sailors the British thought were British subjects.
And because the British would not change that policy, and the United States was determined to try to force them to change that policy, that's why the war happened.
In the United States, Congress continued to prepare the nation for war. Lawmakers voted to increase the size of the army and to borrow money to pay for things the larger army would need. But not all lawmakers wanted war with Britain. Many Federalists, especially, opposed it. Congressman Hermanus Bleeker showed the House a list of hundreds of names from his area of New York. He said all these people opposed the embargo and the idea of war with Britain. It is impossible, he said, that we can go to war when the embargo ends 60 days from now. Where are our armies? Our navy? Have we the money to fight a war? Why, it would be treason to go to war this soon, so poorly prepared. Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin was having a difficult time finding money to borrow. he could get almost no money at all from Federalist bankers in the New England states in the Northeast. Congress had approved borrowing $11 million, but Gallatin found the banks would lend only $6 million to the federal government. The Federalists charged that Gallatin's difficulties showed that the people did not want war, especially the people of New England. If the people of the West and the South wanted to fight, then let them pay for the war. Yet, sure that Britain would not change its hostile policies, President Madison sent a secret message to Congress on June 1st, proposing that war be declared. Madison listed the reasons for war. British warships had violated the American flag at sea. The British Navy had seized and carried off persons protected by the flag. British warships also violated United States waters, interfering with American ships as they entered and left port. Another reason, he said, was Britain's orders against trade with France or allies of France. International law, he said, gave Britain no right to make such orders. Madison also spoke of the hostile Indians of the Northwest Territory and seemed to charge British Canada with helping the Indians. The president's message went to the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives for discussion. The final vote in the House on declaring war was 79-4 and 49 against. In the Senate, the vote was closer, 19-4 and 13 against. President Madison signed the bill into law on June 18th. The War of 1812 had begun. The leaders in Washington did not know it, but 2 days earlier, Britain had ended its orders against neutral American trade. The orders might have been withdrawn earlier, except for a number of events. British Prime Minister Spencer Perceval, under great political pressure, had decided to end the British orders on neutral trade. Businesses and traders were loudly protesting that the orders were destroying England's economy. On May 11th, before Perceval could act, he was shot to death. Not until June 8th was agreement reached on a new prime minister, Lord Liverpool. 8 days later, his government announced that the orders were ended immediately. This was only 2 days before war was to be declared in Washington, and with ships being the only method of communication, the British action was not learned of in time. If the United States had had a minister in London during the spring of 1812, the diplomat would have been able to report progress toward ending the orders. But the American minister, William Pinckney, had returned home a year earlier. Neither Americans nor British were sure they wanted war even after it was declared. The public's reaction will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us each week for The Making of a Nation, our American History series from VOA Learning English.